This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, who has conducted pioneering research into the consequences of modern holocausts that were engineered by man, like the atomic bombing of Japan and the mass exterminations in the Nazi death camps. Lifton studies the psychological impact of extreme situations characteristic of our era. He won a National Book Award for his study of Hiroshima survivors, titled Death in Life. The study led to his continuing research into how nuclear weapons and the fear of nuclear war are radically altering our lives. That was the subject of his book, Indefensible Weapons, The Political and Psychological Case Against Nuclearism. For the past 9 years, Lifton has been studying the human capacity for evil and sadism. He's interviewed former Nazi doctors and their surviving victims. His forthcoming book is titled Nazi Doctors, Medical Killing, and the Psychology of Genocide. Robert J. Lifton is a board member of the group Physicians for Social Responsibility. For more than 20 years, he was a professor of psychiatry at Yale University. He's now a distinguished professor of psychiatry and psychology at City University of New York. We talked first about his study of Hiroshima survivors. He told me the bomb survivors he interviewed all experienced the same phenomenon, which he calls psychic numbing. He describes psychic numbing as the diminished capacity or inclination to feel.
They would describe how when the bomb fell, they could see things going on around them, horrible, grotesque scenes of people dying, and suddenly they ceased to feel, underwent what one called a paralysis of the mind, a sudden experience of emotions not getting through, and I recognized that eventually as a defense mechanism quite necessary to them. There are terms that are used in psychoanalysis like suppression or repression or isolation or denial, but I wanted a single term for overall muting of feeling, and so I chose the term psychic numbing. And one thing I might add, I had a lesson in terms of my own reaction, because at that time when I first began the interviews, and I wrote about this in the introduction to my book on Hiroshima, well, the first few days those interviews were overwhelming, and I felt very anxious, and I wondered whether I could stay and do the study. But after a few days, I found that rather suddenly, I ceased to be quite as anxious. I was still troubled by what I heard, but I found myself able to focus on themes or common themes and responses, taking on the task of the research investigator. And I later recognized this as what I came to call selective professional numbing. It's kind of putting a good light on it because, after all, I needed the numbing in order to do the study, but I also came to recognize it's a sort of danger that we undergo as professionals in order not to feel too much.
There is a phenomenon that you described as death in life. Would you describe that?
Well, when I did the study, I found that from that one split second of exposure to that first weapon in Hiroshima, one underwent what I called a lifelong immersion in death. It could be described in several phases, in about four phases. For instance, at the time the bomb fell, those scenes of grotesque dying around one, and then subsequent, really within days or weeks, experience witnessing or actually experiencing oneself the acute symptoms of radiation, and they were grotesque, and they involved bleeding into the skin and really through all the bodily orifices and great weakness and many deaths. And then over months and even years, the discovery really 3 years later that rates of leukemia had increased among those significantly exposed and eventually rates of most of the common cancers. And then finally, some sense of being in the process permanently, what I call the identity of the dead, in which one felt oneself bound to the dead as if dead. So because of this permanent immersion in death, and it incidentally extends beyond one's own life, since one fears after effects, transmission of genetic effects to subsequent generations, because of this continuous encounter with death and internalization of that death imagery, I call the book Death in Life. I later recognized, I didn't quite realize it at the time, it's a phrase that's been used by Wordsworth and other poets earlier on, but it seemed entirely appropriate for what I was encountering and describing.
Do you think that those of us now, all of us who live in the presence of nuclear weapons, experience to some degree some of the phenomena that you've discussed that the people who survived the actual nuclear blast experienced?
We're not survivors in the direct sense that they were or are, and yet we have certain encounters with nuclear threat that have some bearing on their experience, or their experience has bearing on what we experience. I would characterize our own experience now as a kind of double life, and I've written about this. That is, on the one hand, we know that we could be annihilated in a split second. Everything could be destroyed, everybody and everything we've ever touched or loved. On the other hand, we go about business as usual, as though no such threat existed, and that's the double life. We don't have those searing memories as compared to actual Hiroshima survivors, and in that sense, the threat is odd because it's on the one hand amorphous and in some ways distanced, and on the other hand, it's very absolute. It's one reason why it's so confusing, and there's even a certain amount of controversy about how much it affects us psychologically. And some people have gone so far as to say, quite wrongly, I think, that the effects are not significant. The effects are significant, but they're confusing in their nature.
Well, when you start thinking about nuclear weapons, when you get in a more paranoid state about it, you can start thinking of the concept of futurelessness, that, well, maybe you won't live to your retirement, or maybe your children won't grow up or something. What are some of, do you think that there are any cultural patterns that you could see now that are based on that kind of fear of futurelessness?
I think that the fear of futurelessness is very much with us. And yes, you find, if not clear-cut cultural patterns, you find, I think, really more in the way of hints rather than clear patterns. If you talk to children, they're likely to say, and you ask them what they want to do when they grow up, and they'll say, well, I'd like to become a doctor, or I'd like to have a lot of children, or I'd like to be a writer, or whatever they would like to be. And then they're likely to add, well, of course, if I do have a chance to grow up. It's, again, another version of the double life, which is very marked and poignant in children or in adolescents. I think that there is a shadow cast over every long-term endeavor. Again, it's kind of contradictory. Of course, we seek prolonged involvements and lasting relationships. We need them. On the other hand, we have some sort of inner doubt about whether they'll ever be realized or whether they will sustain themselves, as opposed to some kind of nuclear disaster or Holocaust interrupting everything. That gives us some doubt about every long-term enterprise. It could indeed contribute to short-term goals and impatience with long-term commitments, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that we can find a clear-cut tendency to resist them. Rather, I think we make the long-term commitments but have doubts about them.
You've been spending the past 7 years or 9 years researching the doctors who worked in the Nazi death camps.
Feels like forever. It wasn't only doctors who worked in Nazi death camps, but it was Nazi doctors in general, with a certain focus on Auschwitz. But I studied Nazi doctors, some of whom were involved in other malignant activities, including killing of mental patients or so-called euthanasia, which one has to put in quotes. But anyhow, and some of whom were involved in kind of Nazifying medicine administratively and ideologically. But I did study a whole group of Nazi doctors, and I focused on Auschwitz.
The most, I think, commonly asked question about the Nazi doctors and people like Joseph Mengele is, how can a human being do that? You've studied the men who actually perform the sadistic experiments and help figure out how to efficiently kill lots of people quickly. Do you think it takes a special kind of human being to perform sadistic deaths and mass murders?
Well, I'd put it this way. In the case of Mengele, and I wrote an article about Mengele, really it came from my book that was published a few months ago in the New York Times Magazine, and Mengele, of course, was not an ordinary individual. He was one of the more sadistic Nazi doctors, and he was also an ideological fanatic. Yet even Mengele, with those traits, would probably not have killed anyone were it not for the Nazi movement, and hadn't killed anybody, as far as we know, until he got to Auschwitz. My point there is that certain kinds of ideologies and certain kinds of structures or institutions like Auschwitz that are geared toward killing can release and bring out and magnify, welcome the potential sadism and sense of omnipotence and even paranoia in certain kinds of people. But most of the Nazi doctors whom I interviewed were very ordinary. They weren't especially sadistic, and they weren't even especially extreme ideologues, although they certainly had some of the Nazi ideology. So rather ordinary people, given certain ideological developments, people who start out as ordinary, once they do what they did, they were no longer ordinary, but people who start out as rather ordinary can move into doing some very extraordinary and murderous things.
Is there a connection between the work you've been doing on nuclear weapons and the research that you're conducting into Nazi doctors?
Well, there are connections one could make, and one has to make them carefully. In my work with Nazi doctors, when I came to ask myself the question you asked me, how could they do what they did, the ideology and various Nazi attractions and pressures could lead them very far indeed. But there was a mechanism I came to describe that I call doubling. And by doubling, I mean the formation of a second self, a kind of second self of a person that's rather autonomous, rather separate from the original self. In the case of Nazi doctors, they could form what I called an Auschwitz self. And the Auschwitz self could adapt to the whole killing process, while the prior self was relatively more humane, an ordinary doctor, neither better nor worse than most other men. And that capacity for doubling in murderous environments, I think, is part of the human repertoire. It's something that almost anybody's capable of if the conditions take on certain characteristics. If we look at the nuclear weapons scene, although people involved with nuclear weapons are not Nazi doctors, they don't subscribe to evil ideologies, which the Nazi doctors did. Nonetheless, one can find a parallel process of doubling, the formation of a second self in many people, which could be called a nuclear weapons self. And with that self, one can imagine using the weapons, building them, possibly limited nuclear war, killing only a few million, all those draconian projections that some nuclear strategists have made. That same nuclear strategist may be, in most of his life, a very decent person, quite kind and loving toward wife and children and so on. And to that extent, one can find a parallel in that doubling process. And that idea has been, in my judgment, more or less confirmed by some of the work done recently by Stephen Kull, a psychologist who has been interviewing nuclear strategists.
My guest is psychiatrist Dr. Robert J. Lifton. Can you explain what the role was of Nazi doctors in the death camp and in Nazi Germany?
Well, in a death camp, in Auschwitz, for instance, which I studied especially, and I interviewed a lot of survivors as well as a few Nazi doctors who had been there, what is not appreciated, I mean, it's known that they did all sorts of experiments, some of them fatal, and they were brutal and quite horrible enough. But what is a little less known is that they were actually in charge of the killing process in Auschwitz. They did selections at the ramp, which meant selecting a minority of incoming Jews to go into the camp and work and live at least for a period of time, and selecting a majority of the arrivals, usually up to 70 or 80 or even 90% for the gas chambers. They also selected people within the camp and in the medical blocks, allowing some to live and the weaker ones usually to be sent to the gas chambers, so that they were trying to maintain a relatively intact or relatively healthy, by Auschwitz standards, group of prisoners for the workforce working for IG Farben and for the Nazi war effort. They also would drive to the gas chamber when they did the large selections for people at the railway track where they came to the camp. They would drive to the gas chamber together with an assistant and the actual gas pellets. And the assistant would put the pellets in. The Nazi doctor would be the overall supervisor, even though it became quite routinized, of the process, who had to declare when the gassing was complete and the gas chambers could be open and the process repeated. So in that sense, the doctor was in charge of the whole process, which is a direct reversal of the doctor's healing commitment. That part of the doctor's work in Auschwitz and in parts of Nazi activity is less known.
You spoke to a lot of the doctors. How did they rationalize using their medical skills for for committing murder and for death as opposed to saving people?
They would talk to me about having a kind of step-by-step process by which they saw the pressures on them to be very great, and they tried to see themselves as in some way making the best of a bad situation. It wasn't the way that I accepted their explanation, but they wanted to present themselves that way to me. They would describe how if someone else selected, if it weren't for doctors, then they might select still more people for the gas chamber and say fewer. And they saw themselves as not having created the Nazi system, but of having been caught up in it. That's the way they wanted to describe themselves. Of course, they were left with uneasiness about what they did, and they underwent themselves extreme numbing and a kind of withdrawal. They didn't like to confront the issue. When you look into this kind of thing systematically, as I tried to do over these years, you find out that relatively ordinary people can slide into situations, or even when they are suddenly confronted with situations, as with arriving in Auschwitz, for instance, which was a very major transition for them. No matter how Nazified they'd come before, Auschwitz was still a staggering confrontation for them. Then, unless one makes a clear-cut and definite decision to leave, and they could have done that because they had a certain amount of leverage in the Nazi professional system, the difficulty with that was if they left as they were part of a military unit, the Waffen-SS, they would have been sent to the front in Russia, and there many Germans were being killed. But once they elected not to leave or to stay, there's a tremendous psychological impulse toward adapting, toward reverting from what one Nazi doctor described to me as from being an outsider to an insider. And they then unconsciously and preconsciously and quite consciously to an extent move into that transition process of adaptation and gradually do what one is supposed to do as the Auschwitz self is formed and takes hold. And they find themselves doing these things. Now, many German doctors committed suicide at the end of World War II. Probably a larger number of doctors relatively than other professionals, though it's very hard to have exact statistics. It wasn't entirely out of pure conscience because they were also quite aware that they had no future and probably would have been tried and convicted and given the death penalty as things were at that time. Nonetheless, I think there is the sense that the transgression was greatest in doctors because only they take an oath of healing among the professionals.
For the doctors who did survive and didn't take their life after the war, the ones that you interviewed, was there any feeling of remorse?
Unfortunately, very little. I think, and this a very great German physician who was an anti-Nazi doctor and then became a psychoanalyst who wrote about these things, Alexander Mitscherlich. He died a few years ago, but I became quite friendly with him and talked with him about his work. When we talked about the Nazis in general, he said, you know, what they did, and he meant his own generation, the ones who led the Nazi movement, what they did was so evil and so horrendous that they couldn't touch it in terms of a sense of guilt. And I found that to be true. I found virtually no sense of remorse. What these doctors did in their interviews with me, they were surprisingly open and spoke rather freely once we made the appointment, and they did come and saw me, did come and see me, but they spoke as though they were a third person, as though it weren't they, it wasn't that particular individual who was talking to me, who had been there, that he was talking about. That was their way of both describing their experiences and what they did, and yet not confronting them and avoiding that dimension of remorse. It wasn't a satisfying experience for me morally in that sense, though of course it was valuable psychologically.
I think in a way we want to find out that Nazi doctors and SS leaders were beasts and were really different than us, and that way we know that we and our friends and our family and Americans are just incapable of turning into that, but that's not what you're finding.
Not at all. And I think, you know, if we can look at the truth in a way, we can take better and more constructive action in regard to our own problems. There's one Auschwitz survivor who, you know, had seen some of those Nazi doctors, and he's a very sensitive man, a gifted person. And he said to me after I had begun the work, tell me, when they did what they did, were they men or were they demons? And I said to him, well, of course, they were men, and that's why I went to study them. He said, but it is demonic that they were not demonic. Well, of course, they became demonic in what they did, but he was saying what you just said as well. One would expect appropriately, given the atrocious things that they did, that they would be demonic in essence in order to be able to do them, rather than very ordinary men who became corrupted and then did demonic things, ordinary people moving into demonic acts, as opposed to being inherently evil or demonic, which most of them indeed were not. And that, of course, brings it closer to home. It means that we're not inherently evil, I mean human beings in general, in my view. Rather, we have the capacity for good or evil, and we become what we are, through our own personal decisions.
Sometimes I think we're really just obsessed with death and with mass death, because we're confronting the after effects of the Nazi death camps, the possibility of nuclear war, the fact of the two nuclear bombs that have already been dropped on Japan. And then there's the famine in Ethiopia. There's chemical catastrophes like what happened in Bhopal. And I wonder if you think that there is this obsession with mass death now.
Well, from the examples you gave, you have to first look at what's happening in our century, what's happening now in the latter part of the 20th century. It looks like a lot of death or threat of death on a mass scale. And in that sense, a lot of the obsession with death has a certain amount of appropriateness. The death is everywhere, or its potential. And how can we react otherwise? In terms of the Holocaust of the recent past, the Nazi Holocaust on the one hand, and the first use of atomic or nuclear weapons in Japan on the other, well, these are events of the relatively recent past, and they have shaken us up in terms of some threshold they've gone over. And we know of other related apocalyptic possibilities in terms of environmental destruction and so on. So it's our very technology that inundates us with either death or the possibility of death, along with some evil actions in connection with that technology. That is the starting point, it seems to me, for looking at some of the obsession with death that you mentioned.
A phenomenon I've noticed in the past 8 or 10 years is that many books have been published lately that are almost scrapbooks of the Holocaust during World War II. You know, photos of death camps or reproductions of art from death camps, coupled with survivor stories. I'd just really like to hear how you react to that.
I start out with a certain sympathy for any survivor who wants to record and feels a need to record her or his experience. And that need has to do with what could be called, what I call survivor meaning, the need of the survivor of any situation to give some significance, some inner form to what is otherwise a devastating and unacceptable kind of event in order to have some form and meaning in, again, her or his future life. And that kind of survivor account can be in the service of that. I also have sympathy for the insistence on the part of survivors that we all remember it happened. There's so much of a tendency to resist the idea that it happened because it's so incredulous. We are so incredulous before something that seems so extraordinary and so unlikely. And of course, there are groups that try systematically to falsify or deny the Holocaust. On the other hand, I understand what you're saying. We don't want to just be inundated by horror and fear. And here I'd say the key issue is finding some significance in the Holocaust. Now I'm talking about the Nazi Holocaust, that is useful to us today. In that sense, the events of the past are not simply the past. They have to do with the present and the future. And I mean not only Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but also Auschwitz and Treblinka. There are things we can learn.
You have been studying war and Holocaust for years now, and I wonder what you have to do in your own life so that your life isn't just covered over with the pall of death.
Well, yes, I immerse myself in these things. I'm not really a depressed person. I think that when you immerse yourself in these issues, you need lots of love around you. And you need expressions that are very free and very free of these issues. I'm very drawn to poetry, all the more so in terms of my involvement in such matters. I'm also a fanatical tennis player, and that can do a lot for one. I think that there's a certain relief, though, in confronting these issues. In my case, I do it as part of my creative struggles, and that also makes it more possible. And by confronting these issues and having something to say, however inadequate anything we say on it one knows to be, nonetheless, by attempting that confrontation, one feels a certain relief and a certain beginning contribution to cultural knowledge. And that helps a great deal in one's own psychic existence.
I know some people who are involved with very difficult positions, whether it has to do with healing or it has to do with the kind of work you're doing, researching, interviewing people who've been survivors of Holocausts, that there's this temptation to not allow yourself to have a good time because it doesn't seem fair in the light of what you've witnessed through the people who you're working with. And do you think that's an unhealthy attitude to take?
Well, I think it's very understandable that, for instance, it is an attitude of survivors themselves. Sometimes it's quite unconscious. There's the feeling of having to live what I call a survivor half-life, a kind of discomfort or even sense of guilt that one has survived and others have died. Now, one can transfuse or transform that sense of guilt into a sense of responsibility and commitment or a sense of witness, as most survivors do. But sometimes that can linger on the feeling that one doesn't have a right to joy or pleasure because people so close to one died and one has been so close to that as a witness. I myself think that one needs those pleasures, one needs joy in every way and every occasion and every fashion one can have it. And actually, many people who are deeply committed to these issues can be joyous and are joyous. We see this in groups who do work on them and who work on nuclear weapons issues because they are confronting the issues and, in a way, liberate their minds from resistance to confronting them and have a little bit more openness to joy.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thank you for being here.
You're very welcome.
My guest has been psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton. His books include Death in Life, Indefensible Weapons, and the forthcoming Nazi Doctors, Medical Killing and the Psychology of Genocide. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Jay Goldman and Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.